I think you should build a career in data science.
Welcome to Build a Career in Data Science. I'm your host, Emily Robinson.
And I'm your co-host, Jacqueline Nolas.
This podcast is a data download into all the non-technical knowledge and skills you need to succeed in a data science career. In season one, each episode is about a chapter from our book, also called Build a Career in Data Science. You can buy the book at bestbook.cool and get 40% off with the code BUILDBOOK40%. But if you don't have it yet, you won't get any less enjoyment out of the podcast.
But like, you want one, don't you? Just do it. Come on.
Just like, you know, if we incept them enough, just by repeating this every 2 weeks.
Just lightly reminding them that they want it.
Yeah, very gently. So this week we're going to be covering chapter 11 of our book, which is about machine learning in production, which is a topic Jacqueline knows a whole ton about. She even made a website, put R in prod, all around putting R in production specifically. And I, on the other hand, have, well, we'll talk about like what exactly production is. Maybe I certainly haven't put machine learning in production, but I've done like, I've made like, maybe you could call production things. But I have a lot to learn here. So I think this will be a really informative episode for me as well.
Yeah. And I think the thing is, I used to be like you. I used to have not put stuff into production, and then I just got the opportunity to, and now I have that skill. And I wish every data scientist had the skill because it's super cool and useful and not as hard as you think. You just need that first opportunity to try. So with that, let's talk a little bit about what actually people mean when they say put data science into production or machine learning. In fact, for the purposes of this podcast, let's assume data science is, hey, I'm going to make a model using statistics and stuff or whatever, you know, like people do to like help solve a business problem. And machine learning is, hey, I would like to do that, but I would like that to continuously run. So like, for instance, if we have a machine, if we have a model that the data scientist made that, hey, that can predict the value of houses that might sell, like the Zillow or something, the value of a house before it sells. If you make that model, it'd be really cool if every day we repriced all the homes. And so putting into production means, hey, how am I going to make this continually go? How can I make it so every day we'd rerun this model, or every day we decide which product is the best product to recommend for a customer, or even have it like an API. So the moment a customer comes to the website, at that point, we run the model for them and see the results. But it's like, you're not doing it on your laptop to try and show to your boss or whatever. Like now it's, I would like this to be an actual part of the product that your company is building, or, you know, some core thing. But like, does that make sense?
Yeah. So basically the idea is you want this essentially running automatically, right? Because you wouldn't want it to be like, okay, well, with the home pricing site, like, yeah, it's great if you can update the homes that have been on the site for like a week every day. But probably even more important is a new home is listed. What the heck are we going to estimate that, right? And you don't want to like be sitting at your computer and be like, new home was listed, click, run the model, like, I don't know, paste it into an Excel spreadsheet or whatever, right? Like, that's a bit silly. You want it to somehow automatically be able to rerun, whether it's every night or every time a new listing is uploaded. And so you don't have to, unless there's an error or something, there is no human intervention needed.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And so that's the point. But there is like, it feels like that should be totally different than, hey, I want to run something on my laptop to show to my boss, like this one-off analysis to show them about housing prices. It should be totally different production. But it's actually, I would say, like, the majority of the work is all the same. It is like this, because it's the same model. You train it usually in the same way, usually. It's just, is it going to live in your laptop or is it going to live somewhere else? But, like, the actual work of creating the model and all that's the same. But what's different? It's like, one is, you can't you close your laptop and have your website go down, right? Like, Zillow would be really bad. Or as you said, it'd be really bad if it it did that. Or it'd be really bad if you had to manually rerun this model every time a new house goes on. So, like, what does that mean? It's like, basically, data or software engineers have thought of any number of clever ways to just have a server running, which is just a fancy computer. So instead of putting your Python model on your laptop, you just put it on that other computer, which you can't accidentally turn off because it is in a warehouse somewhere. And like, that's basically it. And yeah, I just like, as a digression on this, I remember the first time I actually found out that these servers, when people talk about servers, it's the exact same thing as a laptop. Like, you could log into it. If it's Windows, it looks just like Windows. If it's Linux, you get the same Linux. I remember the first time I found out, and that was like 8 or 10 years into my career as a data scientist. And I'm like, how come people have lied to me for so long about this?
Yeah, I remember in our book, you wrote like a little blurb that was like the cloud, like fancy sky laptops. So yeah, I think that, but that being said, I mean, I think, you know, I think often this type of thing is more intimidating for people like me who come from the more statistics or maybe a business background, data science, because I think folks who have like a computer science background, right, even if they weren't putting like data science models in production, maybe they're a bit more familiar with like servers, like some engineering best practices versus your stats. It's like, oh, I don't know, there are all these like these terms that can sound really intimidating if you don't know what they actually mean. And then, I don't know, for me, it can be kind of a scary thought of like, oh, I'm putting something in production, I'm responsible for it. Like, am I going to have to be on call? Like, are other people like, you know, what happens if this mic breaks? And yeah, and just this, like you said, this unknown, this thought of like, oh, wow, it feels really different than having it on my laptop. And just like, how many things am I going to have to learn to be able to do this?
Yeah, I think you're right that it's like, it's a trust thing. It's like, I have to trust that you lose a little bit of control, right? When it's on your laptop, yeah. You get to decide when people see it. But if it's running continuously, it's like, oh my God, something could bad happen at any time and someone can notice who is not you. And that's terrifying. But like, I still think in some ways, I would say for me personally, I have found production less terrifying because in general, if something's going to go, this is not really true, but this is how it feels, is if something's going to go wrong with the model, it generally, you know, it generally might happen pretty quickly. It doesn't, you know, you just can't get it running on the server. And when you run on the server, it immediately fails. And then once it starts working, it's like, okay, if it's, we're in the house website thing, millions of houses are being used every day. And so like you will, like errors will happen, but like you will know. So to me, that is far less terrifying than I'm going to make an analysis. I'm going to write, you know, 2000 lines of code. I'm going to show the analysis to the CEO and then it's going to turn out there's an error in it. Like we talked about last episode, that is the real terror.
Yeah. And let's talk a little bit about, okay, like, but practically, right? So I've sort of said of like, oh, I haven't, you know, again, sort of depending on the definition, certainly not put ML models in production. And I'm a data scientist. I'm a senior data scientist. And so like, I wanted to talk a little bit about like how this works practically at different companies with different types of roles, because I think at some companies, it's, you know, the idea is kind of like the data scientist, especially for like stats PhD, right? They like make the model and like throw it over the wall to some engineers to go figure out that putting into production part versus other places. I think like Stitch Fix is one, you're kind of expected to be more of a quote, like full stack data scientist and do not just like the stats parts, putting in production, but also maybe some data engineering work, right? To like get that data. Maybe it's not necessarily like just a SQL query. You have to write a Scala job to get it from Hadoop. I don't know if Stitch Fix uses Hadoop, but I feel like I just want to clear that there's a lot of variation and, you know, some companies don't need ML models in production. Some companies that do need that, you might be throwing it over the wall, or you might be working on a team that doesn't have anything to do with that ML and production side. So yeah, that's kind of my thoughts on it. But I love to hear, you know, Jacqueline, you've been in a bunch of different roles, like what you've seen and maybe some hot takes on what you think are the best way of doing it.
Yeah, well, I guess what I would say is the idea of the data scientist who just builds a model and then hands it off to someone else to figure out how to deploy it, I haven't seen that as much as I heard people talk about it. Like, people act like that's a very common thing. I haven't, and maybe it's just my career or whatever, I've seen that less, because it's kind of like, it's really rough to do that, right? Because if you're the data scientist, you're like, oh, I just trained a model, blah, blah, blah. There's all sorts of assumptions on like, well, what does the data that goes in have to look like? How often do you expect to retrain it? Blah, blah, blah. And if you just pass a model off to another team, it is very unlikely they will get that stuff right. And then they will spend a while trying to fix it. And then they'll come back to you and then you will end up having to do that work. And so it's just, it slows things down. The teams that I've been on that have been the most successful are these, I wouldn't necessarily say full stack data science one, where you're expected to do everything, but the idea that like if something goes wrong after the model is trained in one of the future steps, you are not totally unaware of that stuff. You could dig in a little bit and try and, you know, do a little bit of like debugging, fixing, that sort of stuff. That goes a long way. But then it's important to understand these systems a little bit so you can have those conversations and, you know, get in there.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good insight. I would agree. I also have not seen this kind of throw it over the wall, but it's something I've heard talked about. And, you know, so I'm kind of coming to this with like, okay, like an experienced data scientist who hasn't done this, but, you know, some of our listeners are people, maybe you haven't been working in data science yet. And so I would say I, because of my experience, I don't fall into this, but Chip Huyen, who is a machine learning engineer, who's also like teaching a Stanford class right now. So she had a tweet recently where she is making her slides for a course and she's trying to compare your expectations for putting ML in production versus reality. So the expectation is collect data, train model, deploy, profit. And then the reality is choose a metric to optimize, collect data, train model, realize many labels are wrong, relabel data, train model, model forms poorly on one class, train model, you know, so on and so forth, deploy model, dream about money, wake up to 2 a.m. to complain some model biases against one group, get more model, deploy, et cetera, right? So I think I am more prepared for this because this is also the reality you face when you're doing, you know, non-ML improv, like analysis industry, right? It's like nothing like doing a little personal project on your computer, but I thought I'd share that and see if that resonated with you, Jacqueline. Because for me, it's like, yep, that tracks. It makes sense that it would be similar to this, like, oh, the idea sounds simple, but in the real world, it is much more complicated than that.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times when people talk about like, oh, the difficulties of putting machine learning into production, they're like, ah, but what about scalability? And what about your data lake? And blah, blah, blah. And like, no, it's really exactly what you just said in that tweet of like, no, it's like, oh, whoops, the stakeholders are complaining because this one category is weird. We need to retrain the model. But, and like, so it's so much less about the like infrastructure and mechanics, like underlying mechanics of getting this stuff to work at scale. I find it's much more on the, hey, the same problems you have to think about if you're making an analysis for people, which is like, oh, what about, why is this one bar high in this graph and stuff like that? So it's really very similar skill sets. I think, and I would say, I think one way people get caught up is there are some tools that people use to put things on servers. Like, they don't literally have a computer running in a warehouse. What they do is they either have something called a virtual machine, which is like, hey, that one computer in a warehouse actually is running like 10 computers like on it, that same hardware. And so you just spool up a new one of those 10. And you connect to it that way. And that's called like an EC2 instance. You ever hear it's that. Or there's a tool called Docker, which people use, which is just like a fancy way to do that, where you like specify the entire system of like, I want it to be running this this operating system and have this libraries and have these R packages or Python packages installed and then run this script, blah, blah, blah. And that's like just a better way. And like those tools do take some time to learn. You got to get used to a little bit with a VM. You got to get a little bit used to Docker. But it's not like that hard. If you can learn R and Python, you can learn these sorts of tools too. So
yeah. So let's talk about that, about like getting started. Cause yeah, I appreciate like kind of mindset, like might be as intimidating to think, but you know, let's assume you don't have like a friendly neighborhood, like a data scientist who's put models in production, who can, you know, who you're working with, right? Who can just like download all the info in your brain. Let's say either you're, you know, an aspiring data scientist or you're somewhere that where people don't have that experience, like how can you get started learning this sort of stuff and get practice in?
So that's a great question. So here's what I would do, and this is kind of what I've done historically, is so one of the things people use a lot is called a REST API, which is if you've used other people's APIs, it's basically a website where you put in the URL, you pass it the data with the URL, and the website you get back is whatever your response is. And so APIs are super important all over the world. They're also very important for putting machine learning in production because they're the way you set up the system where if you want to make it so like, hey, every time a new house is listed, we run the model, you can have it be an API and the software engineering code can hit your model API. So you can write your own APIs pretty easily. In Python, you can use something called Flask. In R, you can use something called Plumber. And forgetting even having this run on a server, you can run these things on your laptop. So you can set it up so you have like your API running and then you can go to your browser and you can like type in a URL and that will call your R or Python code, which I think is already pretty cool. And then you're like, oh, well, if I want that to not live on a laptop that when I close it, it turns off, then you start an EC2 instance, which is you go to Amazon, you pay for it. But like that is still the same. If it's Windows, you can literally go to the desktop and stuff, copy and paste your R code, run it there. And then bam, you have now put something in production. And I don't know, I find that as a really cool starting point.
Yeah. So this is going to get a little specific, maybe, but I've personally, like when I've used AWS, I have found the documentation like not great. Like it's extensive, but like it feels like there are 50 pages for something that should be about 8 bullet points. Do you have any recommendations for like resources? It doesn't have to be just AWS, but like other places to learn about this sort of thing.
I think it is a well-known problem that for AWS's documentation in particular is nigh incomprehensible.
Yeah. that makes me feel better.
I would just look at tutorials, like literally, yeah, I'll put rndocprod.com. Me and Heather Nolas have tutorials for R, but there are Python ones. Like there's tons and tons. People have written tons about this all over. Also, you don't have to use AWS. I think the Google Cloud suite is easier to use and has tons of cool features that AWS doesn't. So I guess just try your best. Read the blogs. Try other systems. Yeah.
Yeah. I also want to put a plug here of like learning these types of tools is not just useful for doing stuff in production. Like I was talking to someone where, you know, they want to train this model on a ton of data, but they only really need to do it once to train this model. And then like, you know, sometimes they'll need to like run a new data, but not that often. But they're using, I think it's called AWS SageMaker as a tool to do that, which has like a lot of, which one, so it gives them the computing power they need. They also have lots of like presets. And I remember hearing someone else joke about like learning those tools is helpful because that, you know, no one can predict the future, but that is perhaps like where, you know, in a couple years, that is more where it's going is like that kind of auto ML, that type of stuff, where like that part will be, you know, you don't have to necessarily spend like tons of time like testing different models, right? Or like tons of hyper-trained tuning because some of that can be done automatically. It's going to be in like, okay, the right business problem, getting the data and like learning these sorts of tools that will help do that kind of, that will help assist you when, for example, your data is too big to run on your laptop.
Yeah, and I think I agree with all of that. And also you don't have to do it perfectly the first time. Like the first time I deployed production code, it was like, it was such a sketchy, like, yeah, like I'm gonna spin up EC2 and I'm gonna just like hack away and get this, like technically it is working, but it's definitely not something production enterprise software developer would do. Like, yeah, spooling up an EC2 instance, copy and pasting an R script, hitting run on it, that's not necessarily the most elegant way. There are better tools out there, but like, who cares? It worked. That's fine. I then learned better stuff, and that's fine too. Like, you don't have to use every cool modern day best technology first. Just try getting something working and kind of build on that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think more people are talking about this. Like, Rika Gorn is giving a talk at our studio conference, which we're recording this like the third week of January. So that's in 2 days, which is about getting, again, like a different thing, but like getting our studio, their professional products, like all hooked up with their data. And so that is, well, I don't even know what you would call that, like IT work almost. But I think, again, it's just like practicing this little bit of like getting out of your comfort zone, where maybe your comfort zone has been, okay, working locally in R with like scripts and like, it's okay, maybe, oh, like, let me try like connecting these computers, or like putting something on an EC2 server. Let me figure out a little bit about like security permissions. Like that's great. And don't, you know, don't think that because you came from a certain background that you're not capable of that. Because as I like that you were saying, Jacqueline, it might not be as difficult as you think it will be. And it's okay to just like take small steps at first and not have things be perfect.
Yeah. And I also think to all the points you made, that's great. It's also great because it lets you really talk the language of software engineering, which can just be immensely helpful if your company inevitably has a team of software engineers, right? So when they talk about like, oh, our, you know, our Kubernetes cluster, blah, 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 like you might understand what they're saying enough that that will help you understand like, oh, and that means I should make my model slightly differently for blah, blah, blah. Like just, you don't have to be an expert in the language, but just knowing some of the key words is just a valuable skill to have when working with that, those sorts of teams and people.
Yeah. And I want to talk a little bit about your experience at T-Mobile because your team had some like engineers on it. Is that right? Like you were putting like ML models in production and there were some folks who were maybe not data scientists, but like software engineers?
Yeah. So before I did that consulting project for T-Mobile, the previous project I had done where I had to put stuff into production, it really was stuff that I now look back at and like, that's not the right way. Like I actually was like, there were some systems that were running by me copying and pasting a R script into a Windows server and then doing the Windows server scheduler on it, which all worked, but it wasn't like great. And then by being embedded within a team of software engineers, I learned a lot of the modern stuff like Docker and like really how to do load testing and blah, 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 blah. And like, all of that was super useful and helpful. And I just had never had the experience before. And I assume this is true for most data scientists. Like, you don't generally work in the middle of software engineering. Usually that's a different team that you're somewhat disconnected from. And like, that's just, it's an unfortunate disservice, I would say, to data scientists. Cause like, you, there is a lot of cool skills you can learn there.
Yeah. And I feel like that's even stuff that people who studied, say, computer science in undergrad don't necessarily learn. Cause from my understanding is like a lot of like computer science programs, they don't talk about like Git or GitHub or like other like kind of modern tools of software development. It's a little bit more on the theory and maybe lower level programming language. So that's the kind of thing. It's not even necessarily, even if you're a data scientist who comes with that background, that you would know about like Docker or like Kubernetes or this other stuff, because that's not taught in school.
Yeah, yes, exactly, exactly. And before I started at T-Mobile on the like less good, you know, production systems I made, I would, like I said, manually connect to this desktop, Windows remote desktop or whatever. I would copy and paste a file. I would like put the new file's file path in and blah, blah, blah. Software developers have thought a lot about this problem and how that's not a good way to run stuff. And so there are tools that software engineers use that will take it. And so every time you commit code to GitHub or Git or whatever, it will automatically put that on the server, automatically compile it, automatically run it. And so you don't have to think about anything. You just commit to Git and it does the rest. And like, that is such a better life to live. Like, oh my God.
Like, right. And like, also, like, again, one way you could start out is, Jim Hester has been putting out some resources for our users about GitHub Actions, or Julia Silge has like a great blog post, which I think is about Travis CI, like this continuous integration. So for example, you make an R package, you want to make sure every time you push new codes that the tests you've written to make sure it's still working, like all pass. You can do something called Travis CI and set that up so it will run that automatically with each GitHub push. So that, I think, from my understanding, is now that there's GitHub Actions or some other tools out there, but that could be another way to put your foot in the door a little bit, is like, okay, let me layer this thing on to something I'm already pretty comfortable with.
I think that a lot of the skills you have about putting R or Python into production are very similar to the skills of making R and Python libraries that other people are going to use, right? Like, if you have to write, you know, a Python library, you want to make sure it's well tested before people use it and all this stuff. And like, so a lot of the tools have overlap. And so being better at being better at production systems will help you write better R and Python packages, and the other directions too. Being better at that skill will help you start to put stuff into production. Because it really, at the end of the day, it really all is just, hey, I want to make sure my code is constantly mm-hmm. working in situations where I may not necessarily anticipate exactly what's going to happen.
Right, right. And that you could even think is, yeah, similar principle of like writing unit tests, like writing tests for your code, even for like, you didn't write an R package, but you're like, hey, let me, before I like train this model, let me make sure that like I don't have NAs, or I don't know, like that this, all the values are less than this certain amount or whatever, right? It's just all these steps, like you said, of like the same overarching goal of like making sure you have like, you know, code that runs, that does what it, you know, you wanted it to do, and hopefully as much as possible, like error-free, or, you know, if it needs to be fast, it runs fast. If it needs to be understandable by others, it's readable, so on and so forth.
Yeah, yes, exactly. And it's a very practical skill that will then help you in analyses, help you in thinking through lots of stuff.
With that, shall we take a break?
Yes, you got to it first before I said it. Hey, you. Yeah, you. Real quick, hey, open up your email app. How many emails do you have in there? A lot, right? It sure would be nice if you could categorize them automatically into groups, right? Maybe group all the similar emails together. Well, good news for you. Grouping similar sets of text together is easy with latent Dirichlet allocation, or LDA for short. LDA is an algorithm from the year 2000 for unsupervised classification of text. You give it your corpus and the number of groups, and it will find the groups for you. Now, instead of a plain list of emails, you can have them grouped into buckets like financial or people being nice. Latent Dirichlet allocation is here for you and here to stay.
Woo.
That is the
That's great. I actually used LDA for one of my projects at the bootcamp I did. So
let's not tell our sponsors this, but I actually find LDA to be a problematic algorithm.
Yeah, you don't want them to pull that, like, you know, very lucrative sponsorship. Yeah. Sweet, sweet money. But yes, so ML and prod, right? So we kind of spent the first part of the podcast talking about like, okay, what the heck is it? And then also like, why maybe it's not as scary as you think, and how to get started. But I imagine we might have, you know, some listeners who are like, yeah, I you've either sold me or I was already sold on doing this. Like, I'm super interested, but like, how the heck either do I find a job where I can do this, or if I'm already working as a data scientist, like find some opportunities around it?
Yeah. So I would say, I mean, I think there are really like two different types of data science jobs, right? Okay. Well, okay. So there's analyst jobs, which like there's no, well, actually, okay. Sorry. No, we're going to start. So I would say an analyst job, where it's your job to take data from a database and put it into like spreadsheets and stuff and then show it. That actually gets in some ways somewhat close to production, especially if you're dealing with dashboards and stuff where the dashboards have up every day. And then when they're not up, they get mad. It's like, oh, well, now you should really put some testing in and like flat, like alerts when the data type sheet, like that actually is like a good starting set of learning some of this stuff. But then there's like the decision science people of like, hey, I'm going to use data science to help make business decision. And those people, I find that very hard to get started with production. Because if you're in a job where people are expecting you just to make analyses to share with executives, I really don't think there are very many opportunities to like actually make stuff continuously run, except perhaps for like dashboards or things like that. But even then, it's unclear. And then there are the data scientists who are actually making models that will affect the product, I'm going to be the person helping to build the recommendation algorithm that is going to power the whatever. And those jobs exist. And I think you can get the jobs that are data science, but are adjacent to this kind of more machine learning, getting stuff into production. And then that is actually much easier, I'd say, to make the leap. Like, so find one of those jobs where the data science you're going to be doing isn't to help executives. It is help actually be a part of the product. And I think that that's a really nice place.
Yeah. And I actually knew someone who kind of made that transition back at Etsy. So he was working at the time, we were called data analysts, later became data scientists. I don't remember exactly what team, but like one of the product team kind of doing this like analysis / decision science role. And then Etsy had like boot camps you could do with another team. And he did a 1 month boot camp with a software engineering team. So like that helped him kind of learn about some best practices there. And then actually eventually he was able to transition over to the essentially machine learning and production team at Etsy. So kind of like each step getting him closer to this thing he wanted to do. So that's certainly a possibility if you work at a company where you're not doing it, but you know other teams are. And I think for doing that effectively, it kind of goes back to, I think it was chapter 3, talk about learning on the job, right? Of, you know, trying to do it in ways where you're not putting a huge burden on people who are already busy, but finding ways you can be helpful. You can learn some stuff on your own, but you can also maybe, and then get, you know, maybe if you get like an hour of their time, like every 2 weeks or something, use that really effectively to advance your skill set.
Yeah. And I think you raise a good point. I do feel like actually being able to do data science and production or machine learning, whatever it is, you learn data science and you have a month of intense software development and you will be good. And it's just, where do you get that month from? I think that's like, I just largely agree with that. And yeah, if you're in a company and you can find an opportunity to really just heavily work with a software engineering team, and they don't have to be ML software engineering team, just a software engineering team, that can be really beneficial.
Right. Or you learn tools like other things too, is like, okay, maybe your project, like I know another person who also kind of wanted to do a bit more of this. And for him, it wasn't, I don't actually know what project it was. It wasn't an ML in production thing, but what he learned on this project was dealing with like really, really big data and training with models, because that's what like our search team had to do, because we had, I don't know, like Etsy has like 30 million items, right? So for him, it was like, okay, I'm not going to tackle the like, and now get, let me, you know, run this algorithm in production. But first let me tackle, how do I train something, data that won't in any shape or form like fit on my laptop, and learn some different tools to do that. So again, just like ways to start getting closer to this end goal.
Yeah. And that's actually, I know very little, I would say, comparatively, I know very little about how do you train models on data that's so big you can't fit in memory. I do much more production of, hey, train a model in a reasonable way, but make sure it can run very quickly for lots of people at once, sort of a thing.
Right. Right. And so that's also I think that's a great point, is like, you know, knowing, I think that was a really good call out, because it's not like, oh, ML in production is like this this like one like skill or whatever, and you either have it or you don't, right? There are the aspects of it. So you point out like, yeah, you're good at putting stuff in prod and you know these tools to make sure like it can get, you know, hit 5 million times a week or whatever. But as you said, that was trained like in memory versus like someone who maybe has to train on a much larger data set. And so that's like a different skill.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of like, you can, even if you have nothing, you're nowhere near production, you can actually like production systems, you can learn like a little bit of this. So like, I think just a good example is like understanding how environmental variables work on a computer. That actually can really matter. Like a lot of production systems rely on environmental variables and like how are they stored in a system and how can you change them and who has access and stuff like that. And you can be a decision scientist and never really once think about environmental variables, or you can really try and like get to understand them. And like there's a lot of like just little kind of like nitty gritty, like, well, how is the computer really doing this? That if you can figure out, well, how is the computer really handling this particular thing, it's much easier to go into production. Or like a great example is garbage collecting, or like, you know, which is the computer being like, hey, I'm going to free up some memory. That really can matter in production, depending on what your problem is, if you're not doing that effectively. But like, it can also matter in some decision science cases if you run out of memory because the computer isn't garbage collecting correctly. And like, yeah, just like paying attention, I would say, to that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think, right, just these kind of like fundamental software engineering skills. But like, let's say you're someone who you have the skills, you feel like, look, I have basically all of this, because I do believe there's some things that are hard to learn without actually doing it as part of a job. Like, I don't know, like working with stakeholders we've talked about before, right? Like there's ways you can practice, there's ways you can get better, but like the rubber kind of meets the road when you're doing it. And I'm sure there's some stuff about that in machine learning and prod. Like you actually just need a project around that and you'll learn so much. But you know, what if you're, I feel like for aspiring data scientists, there might be like, look, any position I see around this is like, you have to have a PhD in computer science. Like you have to already have 4 years of experience doing this. Or for people who are data scientists and more decision science analysts being like, the ML team at my company is like very, you know, totally separate, like very closed off, like not interested in me. Or there is no like ML team in my company. Like we've never had any machine learning in production. Like, how do people get the opportunities to do this sort of work?
Yeah. So one, I think you are right. I just do not think there are that many jobs. I do not think that there are that many machine learning in production jobs, just because not that many companies actually have to put machine learning in production. And like, you, it's not like you that team's growing 10x every year. It's like, I don't know, Google's, Microsoft's, whatever. I'm sure they have some, but like, medium-sized retail company probably does not need... Okay, yes, medium-sized retail company should not put machine learning into production. Just buy some off-the-shelf software to choose which products you send to people in emails or whatever. Like,
right.
Yeah.
Or if you only have, like, I don't know, 75 products at one time, like, you don't necessarily need a production thing that's, like, rerunning all the time, right? Let's say, like, I don't know, think of, like, Bark Shop, where I buy, like, dog toys from, right? I think they release toys every month or so. You know, you could absolutely do that with just, like, yeah, the model's running on my computer or whatever, or we have domain experts do it. Like, this is not a system that needs to be, like, you know, handling, you know, thousands of new items are uploaded every day, or like, you know, all these new people are coming in and querying it. So yeah, I think just practically, it doesn't make sense to invest in that sort of thing for probably pretty little returns over, like, you know, even just like a smart default.
Yeah. And so suppose you do get one of these jobs. A lot of times you may be on a data machine learning team, but they might not actually, for whatever reason, have that much new machine learning work to do at that moment, in which case you just become a software developer. Like, and I've seen this happen multiple times, where people who are hired to be machine learning engineers just become software developers because that's what the business needs, which is fine if you want to be a software developer. But if you want to be a machine learning engineer or maybe a data scientist, you know, that's not necessarily what you're searching for.
So the difference you're drawing there is that because they're sort of just maintaining models that other people built or dealing with errors versus building their own?
Let me give a let's give a real concrete example. Suppose you have that that system that is going to predict a house price. Well, you need to write some code that's going to get all the data about that house from throughout the company and then put that into the model. Right, that is important code. You're going to need to write code that takes the output of the model and then shows that in the appropriate place of the website. And if you have one person working on the model, but you have two machine learning engineers at that moment, the other machine learning engineer, they're going to be like, ah, we don't really have anything for you to do right now. So can you write the code that just collects the data from out the company? Which is fine, but it's also not anything related to machine learning. It is about connecting to databases and stuff and feeding
it. Right, it's like data engineer.
Yeah, or some form of software developer. And like it's just very easy to fall into the, well, we don't have enough machine learning work right now. Thus, please do this thing that is next to the machine learning model, but is in fact not machine learning model work.
And the other part, the other thing I've seen is, you know, so we had our whole bonus episode, not our whole bonus episode, a third of our bonus episode about PhDs. And we did talk, like, there are a few, like, some data science positions that do require PhDs, or at least like an intensive research master's. And I have seen that at some companies that that's true, like for their kind of ML and prod team, they want you to have that because part of what the team does is publish research papers. And so like that is a skill you get in, you know, a PhD is like reading and publishing research papers. So that's a case where I think, yeah, well, I remember like, I think they sometimes accepted master's, maybe like people like me with PhD dropouts, but you might come across those positions that like pretty much have a hard requirement for having research experience.
And like, I guess it really depends on the job, but I think for a lot of jobs, it's actually worse. If you're a machine learning engineer, it's worse to have a PhD because like you really should have been spending those years learning more about software development, not esoteric research area. Like if you are like, I don't know, hardcore ML team at Google or whatever, yeah, maybe, but like, yeah, that's just...
But there's some ones like Etsy, I think that was for like the ads algorithm team, because there was a lot of complicated stuff in there about like bidding models and other stuff. And so I think like someone who studied that for a while, that can be a real advantage because that's like a very specific problem.
So, okay, so this is interesting to me. I would class, if your job is really understand the bidding algorithm for Etsy or whatever.
And improve it or and whatever, improve it, right? Yeah. Not just like theoretically.
That to me does not feel like machine learning engineering. That really feels like hardcore data science. Like that's not about Docker containers and RESTful APIs, right? Like that's not about
the production. That's true. Part. I think they did. The idea was they sort of take it through the like, they weren't just like sitting in a research corner. They also were, you know, like make this, okay, that's great if you can figure out the math, but if we can't run it on our, you know, we can't train a kind of model with this math because it never completes whatever, that's not useful. So I do think they were expected to carry it through to deploying a new algorithm.
Yeah, okay. Yes. So that right there to me feels like really like one of those data science jobs that's right on the cusp of machine learning engineer, because you really are trying to like have to deeply understand the inner workings of models and improve them and do some. And to me, an ML engineer is slightly more, I'm really an expert in getting code to run at scale, and I'm maybe not the biggest expert in the inner workings of the model, but the job you're talking about, yeah, I totally see why you need a PhD then.
Yeah, yeah. And there are a few, like I know some folks, like, I don't know, Facebook and like their experimentation team, right? Not all of them, but like the folks figuring out on that, like that little 1% improvement, right? Like really matters. And then you really got to understand. But like, I don't know. I've never been that interested, but I just want to kind of throw that out there. If you are, yeah, there, you might come across jobs like that and not necessarily get discouraged. Yeah, because, and I don't know.
I feel like strangely, I feel strangely that those jobs that you just described, like the person who's making the 1% improvement in the bidding algorithm, like that for some reason for a lot of people is like, that's the job. That's the one job you actually want.
Because I don't know. Maybe it's like the same thing with, we were talking about like the culture of academia of wanting to be like the smartest person. Maybe it's that. Like they also do, I don't know what it actually pays. I imagine they do pay fairly well because that's a pretty specific set of requirements. So maybe that's, I don't know why people are so, maybe it's just, it just feels like, it sounds really smart because it's like, oh, this is a super difficult thing that like almost no one else can do. So that means like I'm extra special and smart.
Yeah. And I guess my takeaway for this segment is I think that's really distinct. I think putting machine learning into production doesn't have to be that at all. It really can be, hey, I'm going to take my simple linear regression model, copy and paste it onto a VM in AWS and just hit run on it. That's machine learning in production. What that, you know, this Etsy thing of like 1% improve the algorithm, that's like hardcore ML research, of which fairly little of ML in production actually is. Most of it is closer to the copy and paste a file into a server than it is that stuff.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, so I'm glad we had this kind of call out. And I also do want to say too, in terms of like you said, there are relatively few jobs, even for that, like, you know, copy it into a VM or whatever and have it run continuously. And I do want to say, it reminds me a little bit of like we've talked before about like, you know, like the reality of working in data science, not like, oh my God, I use the latest cutting edge stuff and like neural networks all the time, is just like I was sort of saying, the business may not, like there's not that many jobs because often what the business needs more is analytics and data science and decision science type stuff. And yeah, that's just kind of the reality. I don't know what to say. Like, that's just kind of the reality of that is like, because those are also the more foundational stuff. If you think of like the data hierarchy of needs, and like below that is even data engineers, which is why, I don't know. I personally think if you do like engineering, if data engineering sounds like it might also be interested in you, I would seriously consider that, not to drive you away from this podcast, but I think there's a big need there, because before you can do even any data analytics, your data needs to be, it needs to exist, yeah, and hopefully be in decent shape.
Yeah, I guess there's a real disconnect between, oh, this is the most prestigious job and you should be getting this one, mm-hmm, blah, 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 and what jobs are actually available and what jobs are actually enjoyable to have. But that said, I said at the beginning, I think this production stuff and like how do you get your code to run when you close your laptop is immensely useful of a skill, even just for fun side projects. If you want to make your own website, yes, that does things, like, it is such a useful skill. But yeah, you don't feel like you have to have this skill for your career to be fulfilling.
Right. But I think, but like we talked about, some of the principles you learn here, even if you're just making that analysis for an executive, maybe you learn more principle, you know, you learn certain principles of, the other person I was talking to, they have to run a report, you know, every year. And the first year was pretty ad hoc because it kind of got this request last minute. But the next year they're like, all right, let's take some time and like make this like, you know, more automated process, like not so good, like run in production, but it was a little more push button when they got the data for the new year. Right. So like those kind of principles, like instead of copying, pasting code, like let me write a function so I can, you know, if I want to change, yeah, I don't know, this thing I'm, you know, I want to add predictors or take it away, I can do it in one place instead of like copying, pasting 20 and maybe have an error. So yeah, just these general kind of good coding practices are immensely useful, I think, in data science.
Yeah, as a whole. Fun. And it's fun.
And fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, basically to recap, right, we've talked through like, what the heck is prod? What is like, how can you learn the skills to do it? What even are the skills to do it? A little bit about, you know, how you can maybe find some projects or positions, but also like, you know, a bit of a dose of realism about like the, just how prevalent these types of projects are. But that, you know, don't let that dissuade you, because the principles you learn will be helpful in other data science work, or as Jacqueline mentioned, like even in your own fun side projects. Like, one thing that, you know, I'll say for our co-author relationship. So Jacqueline's the one who made the website for the podcast.
Yes.
Who's just like, you know, it does like the and like that kind of stuff is, I don't know much about like making a website. So like, just, you know, that's something that is really helpful that Jacqueline just has that knowledge of like some HTML and CSS and like deploying stuff. I mean, I got Blogdown going, but that's about as far as I got.
Well, and I would say what's kind of more fun than just the website is I actually made a tool that on our site, I made a special like how is our book sales website, and what you do is every time you go to that website, it actually goes and calls it actually goes into the publisher's website and like pulls all of our statistics in a way that wasn't necessarily designed to do.
Let me be clear, like also Jacqueline did this because she was too lazy to like log into the website, like the numbers were right available
and you got to click on the
like, I don't know, Jacqueline, oh, it's like this terrible site. I mean, literally all you had to do was log in and all the numbers were right there, but now we have that not behind.
Or, and we had it for a while as a Slack bot and like making it like there's that just fun. All these cool systems you can build that pull data from other places and show it in new places, and that's just fun. Like, what a cool set of tools you get to use.
Yeah. So go out there and learn.
Jeez. Okay, let's take a break.
Okay, wait, what's it?
Just take a break. We're 0-2 on ending our segments this show. Okay, so for our last game, and I think I've asked you this about other things, but have you ever seen the show Billy on the Street?
You didn't make me. You suggested I watch a clip after you referenced doing this with wanting to do this at our studio when it's in person again.
Yeah, so I was tweeting about this because I just think it's great. It's great quarantine watch because it's a loud, angry man running up to strangers on the street and asking them questions.
Street of New York City, right?
Yes, of New York City.
Okay. My former home.
Yes, and so we're gonna do that, but I'm gonna have to slip into persona. So just like give me a second. I gotta like. Okay. Did you know podcasts were invented as a way for commuters to have something to disagree with? Please welcome Emily Robinson for the first time to Jacqueline on the podcast, one of the greatest data scientists in the world, Emily Robinson. Emily Robinson, how are you?
I'm doing great.
This is the dream. I'm just so happy to have you. So now, Emily, you've contributed to so many companies and even helped open source the package FunnelJoin. Was it hard not letting all that fame get to your head?
Yeah, you know, I mean, once you pass a certain number of Twitter followers, it just really feels like, oh, I should just like retire and rest on my laurels here.
Yeah,
and just let, you know, make all my money on Twitter.
You have nearly 25,000 followers. Why don't you think I have that many followers?
I just don't think you're that funny, Jack.
Oof, yeah, that is something you would think. Okay, well, let's move on to our game. A game I like to call Data Science Production System, or Taylor Swift Song Title. Here's how the game is going to work. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready. I wish I knew as much about Taylor Swift as you do.
Great. Well, we're going to see what you know in just a moment. I'm going to list either the name of a data science production system or the title from one of Taylor Swift's 9 album plus singles. If it's a production system, you say production system. If it's a Taylor Swift title, you say Taylor Swift title. If you get enough right, you win a big prize. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Here we go. Data science production system or song title, and away we go. You need to calm down.
Taylor Swift.
Correct. SageMaker.
Production system.
Right. Mirrorball.
Production system.
Mirrorball was a Taylor Swift song. Weights and Biases.
Production system.
Correct. Me featuring Brandon and Uri of Panic at the Disco.
Taylor Swift.
Correct. Starlight.
Taylor Swift.
That's correct. Cloudera.
Production system.
You got it. Red.
Production system.
Sorry, that's wrong. Miss Americana and the Heartbreak Prince.
Taylor Swift.
That's right, Taylor Swift song. Arise.
Production system.
Correct, production system. Algorithmia.
Production system.
Right, production system. Willow.
Taylor Swift.
Right, Willow. Taylor Swift. Splunk.
Production system.
Right, Gorgeous.
Taylor Swift.
Correct, Figure 8.
Taylor Swift.
Incorrect, production system. Speak Now.
Taylor Swift.
Correct, Comet.
Production system.
Correct, Fiddler.
Taylor Swift.
Incorrect. Production system. Kubeflow.
Production system.
Right. Look What You Made Me Do.
Taylor Swift.
Correct. Marjorie.
Production system.
Incorrect. Taylor Swift song. Dayla Robot.
Dayla Robot. Production system.
Sorry. Data Robot.
Data Robot. Yeah. Production system.
Right. Alteryx.
Production system.
Correct. Shake It Off.
Taylor Swift.
Right. Ivy.
Taylor Swift.
Right. Closure.
Production system.
Technically correct. It's both. Domino.
Production system.
Correct. The One.
Taylor Swift.
Correct. Databricks.
Production system.
Correct. Mean.
Taylor Swift.
Technically both. correct. You got it right. That's right. You win. Let's see your big prize. Your big prize is a diorama of Caitlin Hooden cleaning duplicate rows.
Caitlin Hooden. Ah, my favorite.
Woo! That's right. Congratulations.
She's not creeped out. Thank you.
I definitely did ask her permission before
okay,
I did
that's
this.
Good.
Yeah, like an hour ago. I'm like, wait, this is important.
I was having a little bit of a weird shout out to get on a podcast. No, big fans of Caitlin. Also, we'll give a quick shout out because she just retweeted today about her series on motherhood and tech. So she had a baby like a year ago or so, and it was great. And she wrote a post about the experience and also her quote, baby stack. So the you know, products that she found really useful. So everything from like a C-shaped pillow, which is apparently helpful when you're pregnant, to like what actually goes in a diaper bag besides a diaper. So Caitlin's
great.
Yeah,
stuff's important as a kid parent. I agree. That's all.
A kid parent? What other kind of parent?
Parent of children. Not the pet parent. Dog
oh,
parent.
Oh, no. I hate... Oh, my gosh. Our rabbi at the wedding was like, talked about like our fur baby. And I was like, no, I hate that term. But yeah, good. So I would say I was familiar with like 60 or 70% of those.
It's good. You did good. You did good. Well, that is my game. With that, we can end the show.
That's our show for this week. Check us out on our next episode as we discuss working with stakeholders. And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review. You can also tweet at us or share on LinkedIn your data science opinions, feedback on the show, or questions for us with the hashtag DataSciCareer. You can buy a copy of the book at bestbook.cool and use the code BuildBook40%. That's 40% symbol for 40% off. Our theme song is by the extremely funny Matt Fischel, and thanks to our publisher Manning for helping our book exist.
And may you not accidentally delete leading zeros from your strings.